B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comments. It's Monday, March 2nd, 2020. Yes, tomorrow is Super Tuesday. And before we dive into the news and comment, I want to dedicate this podcast to the memory of Joe O.K. Kelly. Joe was a legendary DJ in San Jose, and I worked with him in the 1970s. He died in Tampa, Florida last week, and I don't have all the details on his passing, but Joe was an average dude who loved music, had an encyclopedic knowledge of rock and roll, and working alongside him, I learned quite a bit, and we just reconnected on Facebook less than a year ago, so I'm really going to miss the guy. Keep rocking, Joe Kelly. So they're dropping like flies. First, it was Tom Steyer who announced after his poor showing in the South Carolina primary that he was dropping out. Sunday, it was a turn for Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who did impress a lot of people with his candidacy. And he announced that he was bailing as well. Now, Buttigieg did not immediately indicate who he would endorse. And so I have to admit I was surprised today, in the middle of the day, when I got the breaking news that Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar is throwing in the towel. Now, I at least expected her to hang on through tomorrow, through Super Tuesday, when her home state of Minnesota votes. Unfortunately, the recent polling shows that a guy named Bernie Sanders is likely to win the Minnesota primary. And that dashes all of the claims that Klobuchar has made about how she wins in red districts in her purple state and that her support in the Midwest made her best suited to beat Trump. And I recall at the first debate where Mike Bloomberg participated, that Amy Klobuchar targeted him because hours before the debate, the Bloomberg campaign leaked or just published a memo warning all the moderates to get out and make way for Mike because Bernie Sanders is about to sew it up on Super Tuesday. And Klobuchar said that nobody's going to tell me what to do and that people have tried in the past and it has failed. So what changed in her calculus in 2 weeks? She did get a bump from a couple of strong debates, but she doesn't have the money to compete even tomorrow at Super Tuesday. She pumped a few $100,000 into her home state of Minnesota to try to shore things up when the polls started to go south for her. And I have to say I feel sorry for Amy Klobuchar. As I've told you, I met her at the 2008 Democratic Convention, the coronation of Obama in Denver, and I found her to be an interesting woman who was easy to talk to, very accessible, very capable. And last night, the final rally of her campaign, set at a high school in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, had to be canceled because the protesters took over. And this stems from her work as a prosecutor ages ago, and she convicted a guy named Mayon Burrell, a black teenager, convicted of murder back in 2002. Several people have since recanted, and the case is fluid at this point. I don't know all the details of it. But it did lead to a rowdy protest that prevented her from making a statement to her biggest supporters. And she didn't volunteer to go outside and deliver it in a snowstorm. So I'll leave it to others to lionize these candidates. I think Pete Buttigieg decided to preserve his future. He is betting, and it's a big bet, that if he endorses Joe Biden, and we're told that Amy Klobuchar has already said she'll go to Dallas tonight to endorse Joe Biden, and we understand a plane has been sent to South Bend to put Mayo Pete in the air and to deliver an endorsement in Dallas. And I'll first tell you that late moves in a campaign now, just before the deadline of an election, you know, like Super Tuesday tomorrow, have very limited impact. If you decide to, strike at an opponent at the last minute with some dastardly revelation, well, it doesn't score very well anymore. And likewise, this shuffling of the deck and the endorsements of one moderate to the other, I don't think are going to show up in the vote tallies for Super Tuesday because too many people vote by mail now. And here in California, as of last week, only 20% of the mail-in ballots had been received by registrars. So it is a late process this year. And I, for one, can't understand why people are undecided at this late stage of affairs. And Pete Buttigieg, brought some interesting characteristics to the candidacy. Small town mayor, way out of his league. He performed well on the debate stage. He was good on the stump. But he often offered little more than bromides about how he was going to unite us. He cared more about the day after Trump leaves than arguments over squabbles from the past. But as we have reported to you, there are some great investigations of Pete Buttigieg that show him a tool of the military-industrial complex in a very serious way. So I predict that they will continue to propel him forward, and you're going to see more of Pete Buttigieg. And I cannot believe the kind of spin that the corporate media has put on Joe Biden's victory in South Carolina. It was not at all unexpected. And I can't explain why all those African-American voters think that Joe Biden, who said that 150 million people have been killed by gun violence just last week, I mean, his gaffes and the obvious ways that he's out of touch don't seem to matter to black voters. And here is some of the spin. This is Philip Bump in the Washington Post. Former VP Biden led the field for most of the past year, collapsed in national polling after unexpectedly weak showings in Iowa and New Hampshire. An unexpectedly strong showing in South Carolina on Saturday made clear that his base of voters endures. It was not unexpectedly strong. The biggest surprise was that Tom Steyer didn't score much better because the polls showed that after all that TV advertising that he bought, that he was almost neck and neck with Bernie Sanders. And Sanders came in a distant second to Biden in South Carolina. Again, not the least bit unexpected. But the unexpected part was that Buttigieg didn't make it. And then Tom Steyer, I have to say that when Tom Steyer first announced he was running about climate change, and then he pumped $40, $50 million into pro-impeachment advertising, I thought, what a great guy. But in recent weeks, he has shifted his campaign, kind of his ego, believing his own advertising, and come across as a fairly moderate corporate Democrat. He didn't go full bore against Bernie Sanders, but he made it clear that as a capitalist billionaire, socialism doesn't fly for him. And in the end, he wasn't talking that much about climate, wasn't talking that much about impeachment. He was mostly talking about Tom Steyer. And he spent $175 million in the process. And the only time I felt sorry for him was last night. I was puttering in the kitchen, putting away groceries and fixing dinner, and I had the local TV news on Channel 5, the CBS station. And between 6 and 7 p.m., they ran 7 commercials for Tom Steyer, 2 for the new Elizabeth Warren PAC, the Dark Money Super PAC, and their commercial wasn't offensive, and there were 2 spots for Mike Bloomberg. And I know a little bit about how the advertising game works. And if the Steyer campaign notified this TV station on Saturday night that he had suspended his campaign, they could have canceled those commercials. But they ran them. The cash is already in their hands. I'll bet you he's not getting them back. and I also feel the pain of voters who were staunchly supporting Amy, Pete, or even Tom, who cast a vote by mail, and now that vote doesn't count at all. It's deeply frustrating, and it happened to me in 2008. In the early stages of the primary, I thought John Edwards was the best bet. This was before he imploded into scandal. And it was just about this, the day or two before the California primary, John Edwards announced that he was suspending his campaign. And it really leaves you feeling violated. So I have that compassion for voters who cast a ballot and then their candidate flaked on them. So Bernie Sanders gave a talk in Boston last night. 13,000 people showed up there. And the gatekeepers and corporate media say this is bad form. Here's Bernie poaching voters from his fellow progressive Elizabeth Warren. He's also been campaigning in Minnesota, gaining ground, and some of the pundits who like to play the gender card, the misogyny card, say that, wow, you know, Bernie is just so out of line to campaign in these two states. And the identity politics allow us to level charges of sexism, but we can't get beyond that. Bernie is simply competing with these other candidates on their home turf. Should he not campaign in New York because of Mike Bloomberg? Nobody would ever say that. Should he skip Indiana because of Pete Buttigieg? Is it offensive to gays if Bernie campaigned against Pete? No, he's only singled out for what is regarded as a violation of some protocols when he campaigns against Warren, of campaigning against her, where she is a favorite daughter. The favorite son term is way out of vogue these days. And so we'll see. But the main comment that was quoted from Sanders at the rally in Boston is that Democrats are very nervous about his ascent. One of the things they're really nervous about is what's going to happen here in California tomorrow. In Friday's podcast, I shared with you some of the findings of the IGS poll here in California. It comes from UC Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies. It's run by one of the most respected pollsters in California, Mark D. Camillo. And it just so happened that Friday night, Kathy and I decided to go to a presentation by Mr. D. Camillo at the public library in Mill Valley. And he had a screen and PowerPoint, and he walked us through the polling that he has been conducting. And while DiCamillo himself showed some bias, he assumes that Sanders cannot score in Florida because of the entrapment by Anderson Cooper on the Fidel Castro question. But when you see the growth, Bernie Sanders was at 17% in California last June. Now he's at 34%. Joe Biden doesn't even show up on this chart, but he had a huge lead going back just a few months. And what is fascinating is to see the breakdown. When you hear all these pundits based on South Carolina say that Sanders can't score with African Americans, 38%. He's got the biggest share of black voters in California. Latinos, biggest share, 51%. Asian Americans, biggest share, 37%. You know he dominates the younger voters. I've explained to you that it's the boomers. Yes, boomers. Okay, boomers. Who are holding out on Sanders. That was very apparent in the audience at the public library the other night. But get this. Sanders, who is seen as so extreme, and his agenda is just so radical, right? Well, he has command and control of the self-described very liberal voter, 50%. He has the biggest group of somewhat liberal voters, 28%. And he is tying with Bloomberg at 23% among moderate and self-described conservative Democratic voters here in California. So, will there be a measurable impact from the withdrawal of Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and Steyer? Well, Steyer was only polling at 2% last Friday in California, so he don't matter. And Klobuchar, let me get my stats here, is at 6%. Pete Buttigieg at 11%. Joe Biden at 8%. So theoretically, if just a handful of Klobuchar and Buttigieg voters, not a handful, but a significant number, flip over, that could allow Joe Biden to become viable in California and pick up some delegates. It's also based on an assumption that Mike Bloomberg will not get over 15%. And at 12% currently in the polls, anybody's guess. Will all his TV ads pay off here in California? Well, it didn't work so well for Steyer. So, a couple of the sub-findings in this poll. Overall, Democratic primary voters split with a slight majority favoring bigger, bolder, but harder to win changes. Sanders backers, 9 out of 10 favor bolder, but harder. And there are a lot of people who are afraid of that. They think, I believe it's learned helplessness. Don't rock the boat. We just got to beat Trump. Can't have Medicare for all. So 34% of likely primary voters say Sanders has the best chance to beat Trump. Bloomberg is at half of that, and 12% for Biden. Sanders' own voters, especially likely to consider him electable, 81%. And then they play the who will you vote for if your candidate loses game. And this one really bugs me. Because in an article about suburban women who are not so sure about Sanders, they show how many of them say that if Sanders is the nominee, they'll vote for Trump. But among Sanders supporters, 64% say they favor a candidate who agrees with them, and would they vote for him? Would they vote for another candidate? Overall, nearly 8 in 10 Democrat primary voters say they would back the party's nominee no matter who. Among Sanders voters, just under 7 in 10 make that pledge. So they're viewed as not real Democrats, they're disloyal, not sufficiently committed to beating Trump. But hey, Mike Bloomberg is a real reason not to vote for a Democratic nominee. And the corporate media gatekeepers present arguments, essentially, that say it's okay for other Democrats to refuse to support Sanders. It is not okay for Sanders supporters to refuse to support other candidates. And I argue that this is polling that impacts public opinion. And the time to make these kind of calculations is September, October, or the early days of November, not in the middle of a primary when your advocacy and loyalty to a specific candidate is at its peak. So on to the suburban women. This is the latest reason presented in news reports by the New York Times why Sanders is risky for Democrats. And they use anecdotal quotes. They trot out individuals who have these feelings. But it's about their feelings, not about the real importance of the political issues and the need to defeat Trump. So here's that purity test from the moderates. Nearly 1 in 5 suburban Democrats say they would not support Sanders against Trump in November. I don't think Bernie can win, said Pat Barner, a retiree in Virginia Beach. Now, that's a quote that is tied to an argument that is unsupported by the facts. And the media is amplifying these individual voices because the polls don't support these notions. And this gets really frustrating because of the clear double standard applied to Sanders and his voters. Then we get the dispatch from Silicon Valley. Leaders say anyone but Sanders. And they trot out all these billionaire tech entrepreneurs and executives and say, oh, Bernie bad, Bernie bad, Bernie bad. But get this. At Google, the parent company is Alphabet. Sanders has received $500,000 in contributions from individuals. And Buttigieg raised just under $300,000 from employees. So just like everywhere else, there's a big divide between the people who make a gazillion dollars and the people, say, at Google, who only make a couple of $100,000 a year. The disparity is similar, even though the wages for rank-and-file people are much higher in Silicon Valley. At the New York Times, pundit David Leonhardt is writing off Mike Bloomberg. That's the good news. He says, if you're a Democrat, this is his opening line. If you're a Democrat who doesn't want Bernie Sanders, your choice is now clear. You should vote for Joe Biden. I mean, how explicit does the media have to be in instructing the morons who don't think for themselves on what the approved move, the approved choice, and the proper range of political discourse can be? Now, here's a casualty of the divide among Democrats. Bernie Sanders held a rally in Los Angeles on Sunday, and it was promoted that Public Enemy would be appearing. Ah, but there's a rift among the members of Public Enemy, and Flavor Flav has sent a cease and desist letter to the Sanders campaign, objecting to the unauthorized use of Flavor Flav's likeness and image to promote that rally. And a lawyer for Mr. Flav said that Sanders had been endorsed by Chuck D., but not by the group and not by Flavor Flav. I hope they can work that out in rhyme, all right, if that's not too much to ask. I've linked to an op-ed at The Guardian today under the byline of Theodore R. Johnson. It says, don't assume that black America has spoken in South Carolina. And he makes good points that African Americans in different regions of the country are different. They're not all Baptists. They're not all deeply religious. They're not all conservative. Like many white voter groups, the older African Americans are certainly more moderate and more conservative. So he closes by saying, black voters outside the South will remind an absent-minded nation that black voters in no one state speak for the group as a whole. And while pundits have been able to get away with simplistic analysis in years past, this year looks to finally spotlight black America's political diversity. I want to note that there are some structural issues facing the collection and tallying of the votes on Super Tuesday. There are alarming numbers that show that people like me who are not members of the Democratic Party, but who are permitted to vote in the Democratic primary, we're called NPP, no party preference. It's a dumb designation, but that's what we've got. And because most people vote by mail in California, what we're seeing is only about 20% of likely Bernie voters have returned their mail-in ballots so far. And the statistics on the number of those voters who asked for a Democratic ballot to vote by mail are alarmingly low. Now, those people have the opportunity to take their unmarked absentee ballot to a polling place tomorrow and ask for a Democratic ballot and vote at the polls. But I'm afraid that too many of them find this a confusing process. I don't see it as that confusing, but it certainly does present a barrier for many people. And at The Guardian, they report on issues for voters in Texas, where they have shifted to the new vote center concept. So you don't have your local school or church polling place. It's a larger facility, and there are fewer of them scattered across a county or other jurisdiction. Now, in Texas, some 750 polling places have been closed, replaced by these voting centers. And at this point, I can't tell if that will affect the outcome. I do know that there are hordes of election protection people all over the country monitoring the vote count and the process, and I hope they will raise holy hell if they find rigging or other compromising factors. So today, one Jewish candidate for president who claims to be a Democrat attacked the other Jewish candidate for president who is the front runner. Mike Bloomberg went over to AIPAC, and he dinged Bernie Sanders for refusing to accept the invitation. Quote from Bloomberg, "Unfortunately, not all my fellow Democrats in this race." I love that, fellow Democrats. He's been a Democrat for 2 years. One of them, Senator Sanders, has spent 30 years boycotting this event. And as you've heard by now, he called AIPAC a racist platform. Well, let me tell you, he's dead wrong. Calling it a racist platform, Bloomberg says, is an attempt to discredit those voices, intimidate people from coming here, and weaken the U.S.-Israel relationship. Well, that's not really true. It's about repudiating the outsized power and influence of this group that doesn't even bother to register as a foreign lobby. And the way they brush up against our campaign finance laws in organizing AIPAC members into funding selected approved candidates. More from Bloomy. "I will never impose conditions on military aid, no matter what government is in power." Pointing out that Israel is on the front lines, countering American enemies in the region, sharing valuable intelligence and experience. "Conditioning foreign aid wouldn't only impair Israel's ability to keep itself safe," he said, "but our ability to keep ourselves safe as well." He will always have Israel's back. He's opposed to BDS. Now, I understand that Benjamin Netanyahu came to address the group on Sunday, but I can't find any coverage of that. We'll get to the Israeli race before the end of this podcast. Today, there's a fresh PBC podcast over at whowhatwhy.org, and Mike Bloomberg figures into it because he made those comments defending his stop and frisk program and claiming that male minorities 15 to 25 are responsible for 95% of murders. And Ann Kim, the author of a new book about that age group called Abandoned, not only says it's wrong, it's a harmful stereotype. I've linked to the interview in the show file for today's podcast, and I hope you'll check it out at your convenience. Whitney Webb reminds us that Mike Bloomberg was a buddy of Jeffrey Epstein. She publishes a picture of Bloomberg with Ghislaine Maxwell, the woman who was the longtime procurer of young girls for Mr. Epstein. And Leslie Wexner, we talked about him in our recent podcast about the whole Epstein case. And Wexner, who has announced he's selling Victoria's Secret, well, it turns out Mike Bloomberg owns $150 million of the $136 million, pardon me, of the company that is taking over Victoria's Secret. Bloomberg and Epstein shared close friendships with Mort Zuckerman, the magazine owner. Another mutual Epstein-Bloomberg associate is Harvey Weinstein. And another member of the investment group that Weinstein-Epstein tried to buy New York Magazine in 2003 was Donny Deutsch, the guy who I have never understood why MSNBC put him on the air. Good information from Whitney Webb, and we certainly appreciate her contribution. And finally, in today's political campaign stack, I want to recommend an article at FAIR, That's fairness and accuracy in reporting. They reviewed the questions put forth by the corporate media moderators at the debate so far. 161 asked about health care. When Medicare for All has been brought up, it's been overwhelmingly associated with negative impacts, like forcing people off their private insurance. They also note that on other issues like military intervention, when, on a limited basis, foreign policy comes up, it's always framed around the Pentagon's intentions and trying to protect and preserve those. Of the questions on Afghanistan, 7 exhibited a distinct bias toward intervention. Only 2 framed intervention as potentially negative. So these are just quick snapshots from their study, and I encourage you to take a look when you have an opportunity. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. There's Don Cisney, DGL, Jim McHugh, and Julie Dupree. They each chip in $5 or $10 a month to help me keep the lights on here and pay the bills. And you can do it too. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page just like David Brown did when he opened up a $20 a month subscription last week. He's my neighbor here. Thank you, David. I really appreciate it. So this gets into really dangerous territory. As you know, I was a skeptic of Russiagate. And while Trump obstructed justice, you know, I don't believe the claims that he colluded with Putin to rig the 2016 election. He called that a hoax. And unfortunately, he is partially right. Then came Ukraine. And I am persuaded by the testimony and the evidence, not fully available, that was presented during the pre-impeachment and the impeachment. Trump calls that a hoax. And that I consider to be a lie. So now he is calling the Democratic response and the media coverage of the coronavirus a hoax. This is deeply dangerous. To take an issue like this that has generated a lot of concern among most Americans and turn it into a partisan food fight, and of course blame the Democrats for starting it, is just so unseemly. And central to this, he makes claims that CNN is doing everything they can to instill fear in people, while some Democrats were trying to gain political favor by saying a lot of untruths. It's their new hoax, he says. But it's not a hoax. And that's very apparent. And he even has gone so far to say that people who attend his mob rallies are very safe. Now, it's fair to say that any political rally could include somebody who's carrying the coronavirus. But what will it take? Will it take a group of people who attend one of his mob rallies to get sick? And I don't wish that on them, even MAGA maniacs. But is that what it will take? Somebody he cares about, one of his voters? A situation that can be blamed on him for gathering thousands of people together to hear his bizarre rants? And so, this effort to divide Americans didn't come from Moscow. This is not the claims from the intel community that Russia's trying to meddle in the 2020 elections. This is Trump intentionally minimalizing the risk while maximalizing his response. And both of those are false. And we can pay quite a price for that. Now, Iran is the nation that records the highest death toll anywhere outside of China. And a top advisor to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, a man named Mohammad Mirmohammadi, age 71, died in hospital in Tehran on Monday. In Iran, they have 978 infections, 54 deaths. Now, I'm not promoting any particular theory here, but if you just look at the hypothetical angle that the coronavirus is a bioweapon. Then you ask yourself, well, which two countries have been most impacted? China and Iran. And which countries are on Trump's radar? Countries that he wants to see knuckle under to his will. China on trade, Iran on nukes and missiles. And again, I'm not saying that that is anything conclusive. But until they pass a law that says we're not allowed to think about things, I will continue to raise these possibilities for your consideration. And we will continue to look for evidence to support or refute theories of that sort. So we now have two deaths, both in Kirkland, Washington, outside Seattle, from the coronavirus, both people who were medically compromised in some way. And it is unclear how far this will spread. We're told that it's relatively mild for 80% of the people who become infected. But there are so many known unknowns that we are left basically to fend for ourselves. So Trump today took to Twitter, where he loves to just tweet at us. I was criticized by the Democrats when I closed the country down to China many weeks ahead of what almost everyone recommended, save many lives. Democrats were working the impeachment hoax. Now they are fear-mongering. Be calm and vigilant, he says. Well, I don't believe anything he says, especially on Twitter. And get this. Billionaire pals of Trump have bought up a $1 billion stake in Twitter. We don't know their intentions, but they have nominated people to the board. One of their beefs is that founder Jack Dorsey also runs a company called Square. And Dorsey only holds about $500 million in the shares of Twitter. And he doesn't have the kind of voting rules that Facebook and Google have to prevent outsiders from staging a hostile takeover. And Jack Dorsey has announced he plans to spend 3 months this year in Africa. He hasn't decided what country yet. So he does appear to be vulnerable. But God, to have Paul Singer, the vulture capitalist who is trying to bring down Puerto Rico, the guy who Greg Palast has exposed repeatedly, to put him in control of Twitter? Ooh, okay. Now, this was a huge setback. It happened late Friday. A federal appeals court, the D.C. Circuit, they dismissed the lawsuit brought by the House Judiciary Committee trying to enforce the subpoena aimed at Don McGahn, the former White House counsel. Now, Trump flatly refused. He stonewalled it. And this court has sided with Trump, and they have dismissed the lawsuit from the House of Representatives. This is another huge setback for constitutional rule, for the separation of powers, for the checks and balances they taught us back in the third grade. And the court gamely argues, oh, well, Congress has other remedies. That's bullshit. They are ducking this for political reasons. And this sets up the roots of dictatorship. Authoritarian rule, where Congress can be over there screaming, yelling, sending paper to the White House with legal demands that can be ignored. And we have to think particularly about an authoritarian like Mike Bloomberg. What would he do with that kind of presidential power if he is a subject of investigations that he doesn't like? So it will be appealed. But, as we'll see in a minute, the Republican courts, including the Supreme Court, are not interested in, at least my view, of constitutional rule. Also, I'll mention briefly, and we'll come back to it when there are presumed Senate hearings on his confirmation, but Trump has decided to try again to nominate a loyalist from Texas, Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe, to run the Director of National Intelligence Office. Now, they floated the name last summer, and even Republicans said, no, he's too partisan, he doesn't have any experience. But emboldened by the court ruling I just told you about, by the lockstep of Republicans who blocked even hearing further witnesses in the impeachment proceedings, Trump feels he's invulnerable. He could put Don Jr. up there, or even Eric, even Barron. We have hit a new low. So on Sunday, a federal judge ruled that Trump's latest appointee over at Homeland Security, Ken Cuccinelli, who nominally is the head of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, well, the court ruled that he was unlawfully appointed to that job and the two policies that he's put in place that limited asylum seekers' access to legal counsel should be nullified. Now, of course, this will be appealed, and you can expect Republican judges to side with Trump. But fundamentally, Cuccinelli's appointment is not consistent with the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, and so his actions are null and void. The Supreme Court has thrown out a lower court's ruling in a manner that is ugly and consistent with its ruling last week. Last week, as you know, they dismissed a case brought by a Mexican national whose son, 16 years old, had been shot and killed by a Border Patrol agent when the 16-year-old was on the Mexican side of the border. Supreme Court essentially immunized the Border Patrol agents from any liability from a person who is not on U.S. soil. And so they took the action in a similar case that goes back a few years, just to show how maddeningly consistent they are when it comes to justifying the unjustifiable. And the Supreme Court today announced that it will consider a landmark immigration case related to the asylum process and whether you can send asylees outside the United States to wait, whether they have a right to access to federal courts because the immigration courts are not real courts, even for kangaroos. And here's the ultimate from our jaundiced court system today. The Supreme Court today agreed to hear a third major case on the Affordable Care Act. Chances are the oral arguments won't come up until after the November election, but they could accept the case and by next year in the spring have completely dismantled Obamacare. Finally today, Israel is voting, and it's anybody's guess whether it will be the blue and white party led by Benny Gantz or the Likudniks headed by the discredited Benjamin Netanyahu. And in ways that comically imitate the U.S., we have seen ugly revelations of secret recordings that are impacting both sides. So this started last week when an audio recording that was made secretly by a rabbi who was being visited by a Benny Gantz advisor seeking some sort of religious or moral advice. Well, the comments that were released and played on Israeli television came from a Tel Aviv rabbi, Guy Habura. Remember his name. It'll come up again in a moment. And it exposed Israel Bashar, Benny Gantz's chief campaign strategist, who told his rabbi that Gantz is a danger to Israel. He doesn't believe Gantz would have the courage to attack Iran. So the Likud members jump all over this. And two nights later, another broadcast carried another clandestine recording, this time of Nathan Eshel, the longtime advisor, former chief of staff to Netanyahu, who paints a less than flattering portrait of Likud's strategy, saying it was motivating the party's supporters by using hate. The tactic worked particularly well in non-Ashkenazi Jews, or Sephardic Jews of non-European descent. And Eshel went on to describe the cultural minister, a Jew of Moroccan heritage and a Netanyahu ally, as an animal who helped whip the Likud supporters into the desired hate-driven frenzy. Ah, but then there was a third recording. Netanyahu had been asked to do several television interviews Saturday, asked about if he had anything to do with the recording of Gantz's campaign consultant with the rabbi. And in the recording, Netanyahu can be heard on a conference call with Rabbi Habura and others discussing the plans to release the Bashar audio. There is no bottom to which they can sink. Thank you for listening to my daily news and podcast. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. We'll comment on Super Tuesday on Wednesday. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.